You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's been a difficult year for grieving between the high death toll from COVID-19 and limited opportunities to get together. We'll talk to a professor who created a hands-on way for those dealing with loss can feel a little more connected to those who have passed on. Now, in his virtual State of the State address last week, Governor Tony Evers called the legislature into a special session, the goal to overhaul the state's unemployment insurance system and the way unemployment claims are processed.
I'm announcing today I will be calling a special session of the legislature to take up a plan to modernize our unemployment system and help ensure nothing like this happens to the people of Wisconsin again.
As the pandemic hit, unemployment claims spiked, backlogs followed, with some Wisconsinites waiting as long as months for benefits. The Department of Workforce Development announced at the end of December that the backlog was cleared. But with more federal assistance being proposed in Washington and unemployment numbers holding steady at a high level, there's more work to be done. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been unemployed in the last few months? Were you able to access benefits? Do you still need support? How do the additional federal unemployment dollars factor into your situation? What questions do you have about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy Pahacek is the secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Secretary Pahacek, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start with Governor Evers' call for lawmakers to work with him to update the state's unemployment system. What kind of things were you hoping to see that might help modernize our unemployment compensation system?
Sure. So, Rob, we need a full system overhaul. We need an entirely new benefit system to be able to efficiently and effectively administer benefits for the state of Wisconsin. I think you're probably aware or may have heard by now that the current system is 50 years old. It's a mainframe COBOL system that is just very difficult to program. It's got a lot of manual processes, and it just causes a lot of extended delays when trying to administer benefits.
Lawmakers have said no. In effect, I think they're not going to do anything. They say the state has the funds on hand. The governor has the authority to kick this off already. Are there things you can do without new legislation?
So we've done a lot of pre-work already, Rob. DWD back in 2019 issued what's called a request for information, and that was to gather as much information about current benefit systems that are in the market now. The teams had demos, had vendors come in, talked to other states, did a lot of research. But in order to keep this process moving, we would actually need to issue what's called in government a request for proposal. So it's an RFP. And in order to do that, we need to have an appropriate funding mechanism. There were some funds that had been identified by lawmakers. All of those funds are encumbered. Those are current budget items that we need to keep the department moving. We need to pay salaries. We've got other contracts and fees we have to pay. So we don't have access to the funds right now to get this process moving.
Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Republican, had this to say about the backlog and who's responsible.
These failures weren't brought on by ancient systems. They were brought on by a lack of leadership. These failures brought unnecessary hardship to Wisconsin families. The Evers administration owes these families answers and, in many cases, an apology.
Now, you entered the secretary designee post after the initial backlogs, but do you think there's more that could have been done by the administration, even in the face of the difficult machinery?
So, Rob, I mean, what caused the backlog is the pandemic. I don't know if you've heard some of these statistics that have been out there, but from March of 2020 through December, the Department of Workforce Development received approximately 9 million unemployment claims. And in the 4 years preceding 2020, so from 2016 through 2019, the total amount of claims filed in those 4 years was 7.2 million. So the department faced an avalanche of claims. It was over 4 years worth of work in 9 months. And that was exacerbated by the antiquated technology that sort of hamstrung the department. And it was really just an exercise of once this pandemic hit, trying to staff up, trying to, get additional resources in, and ultimately trying to get technology in that's going to kind of prevent this from ever happening again.
We are talking about Wisconsin's unemployment system with Amy Pahacek, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, and with you. If you have thoughts on how things went over the last year, 800-642-1234, maybe an experience for better or worse, 800-642-1234. So now here we are, Secretary Pahacek. The backlog is caught up on as of the end of December, I think it was. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean everybody who should be paid has been paid, or is it something slightly different than that?
Sure. So I think it's going to help if I can sort of explain the definition of the backlog.
Sure.
So the U.S. Department of Labor is the jurisdictional authority over all the states' administration of unemployment benefits. And USDOL sets certain standards that the states aim to meet when they administer these benefits. And one of the standards is what's called a timeliness standard. And that indicates that states should be processing and making a determination on any claim filed within 21 days. They actually have an 80% of claims should be determined within 21 days. Of course, we want to beat that. We want 100% of the claims determined in less than 21 days, but that's sort of the first milestone. So when I got to DWD in September, there were approximately 100,000 individuals. It was over 97,500-ish in there, individuals who had been waiting for a determination. And what we found was that most folks had been waiting to even get into the hands of a claims adjudicator, just given the volume of claims. So our first goal was to get that cleared and get all claims older than 21 days either resolved or in process assigned out to an adjudicator. And that's what we were able to do by the end of December per our goal. And that actually put us ahead of where we were in terms of timeliness standards from December of 2019, so pre-pandemic. So we were doing better than we had been with timeliness before the pandemic. But that doesn't mean that everybody has been paid, and those folks who filed within the last 21 days are still in process. But that was our initial sort of milestone, and we're going to continue to make improvements on those standards and continue to be as timely as possible going forward.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Chris?
I just had a comment. I'm a self-employed contractor out of Madison, and we applied for unemployment through the PUA. And we had to send in our tax forms to kind of prove income, and my experience was tax forms got lost. It was impossible to get phone calls. When I would talk to reps, either I was being hung up in the middle of the conversation, or we would file an appeal and call back, and there would be no record of anything happening. Incorrect amounts. I mean, you couldn't get a phone call returned from any adjudicators. It was a complete disaster as far as I was concerned.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. So a couple things there. First of all, Chris saying it's just hard to talk to somebody, hard to get calls back, hard to get information, especially in the earlier days. Secretary Pahacek, are things better than that now when people make that initial claim?
Yeah, certainly. And I'm sorry to hear, Chris, that your experience was less than satisfactory. Back in July, there was issues with call center, representation. The department really needed to get on additional contractors and folks. And I know at one point an audit showed that, I think it was around 1% of calls were getting through. What we found as those new agents came on board and resources were expanded, since I have been at DWD, it's between 80 to 95% of first callers get through immediately. And those who do go into the hold queue are typically responded to in less than 5 minutes. So certain improvements there. And I do want to just make one additional comment about PUA, which is the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance benefit that Chris referenced. That is a federal program And the requirements by which we must administer that are outlined by the federal guidelines, as you know, indicated by DOL. So we have to follow those rules about what documentation is required. But Chris also brings up two additional sort of comments that I would like to address, just about how to get documentation to the department and how to communicate with claims adjusters. Because that is something that I found when I came had been a real deficiency, and that kind of goes back along with the technology. But we since have started, sort of based on that assessment of some of these huge shortcomings that the department had, you know, we recognized that in order for a claimant to get documentation to the department, they either had to mail in documentation or fax it. And when I first heard this in September, I was shocked. I mean, a fax machine, I can't even tell you the last time I saw one. So that is one of the initiatives that I started since being at DWD, is some of these short to midterm technology solutions that are really going to help with efficiency. So right now we have a prototype document upload system where folks will be able to just upload docs right off their phone or their laptop automatically. That will then sort of automatically load into their claim portfolio so that we don't have to do manual entry. And then also when it comes to being able to talk to their claims adjudicator, you know, right now, in order to have that communication, a claimant must call the call center, set up an interview time. You know, if something comes up and the claimant's no longer available, then they have to call back and reschedule. I mean, these are the systematic problems that, you know, really add to the delays. And so we also have a project underway that, you know, should be available here within the next few weeks, of secure messaging right through the portal, so that if a claims adjuster or adjudicator needs to reach their claimant, has a specific question, they can put this message on the portal. It'll send that via a text to our claimant, just to help facilitate that exchange of information, which will just, you know, gain workflow efficiencies.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Amy Pahacek. She leads the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the state's unemployment system. Have you encountered that over the last year or so? How did things go? Do you see things running more smoothly if you filed recently? What questions do you have about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Amy Pahacek, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, looking at unemployment compensation and claims here in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your comments and your questions. Let's go back to your calls now. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. See, when this whole thing started back in March of last year, it was accompanied with a $600 weekly benefit, part of the stimulus package. That went away. I thought that was supposed to come back in the form of $300 a week for once Trump signed the bill and after Christmas. So when is that additional $300 supposed to start, and how is that going to work?
Thanks for that call, Secretary Pahacek. We have this new federal economic relief package. When should, or what does it change for unemployment? When should people expect to see it?
Cindy is spot on that she's referring to the federal pandemic unemployment compensation, which was previously through the CARES Act, $600 per week. Through the new legislation, which is the Continued Assistance Act, that is $300 a week, and that is available to anyone who qualifies for at least $1 in underlying benefits. So that could be regular state unemployment, it could be pandemic unemployment assistance, and that is available now. We started paying that last week, and individuals would just need to go in and file their regular weekly claims, and they will receive that additional $300 at that time. That's an 11-week extension, by the way.
Cindy, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Paul now in Lake Geneva. Paul, hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Paul?
Yes, I just wanted to respond to the Robin Voss call that was thrown in. To me, that sounded like a very partisan just response that like, oh, it's, you know, Tony Evers has your answers or he owes you an apology. This is ridiculous. In the world of computers, Wisconsin's unemployment computer systems is beyond ancient. So what would it take to move the needle and get some updated equipment here?
Paul, thanks for the call. You touched on this a little bit earlier, Secretary Pahacek, but what would it take to have a, I don't know, late 20th century system, much less a 21st century system?
Yeah, it would. And thanks for your comments, Paul. It would take that full system modernization, which Governor Evers has requested that special session so that we can get moving on that as quickly as possible. But we certainly agree that a brand new modern system would greatly reduce the possibility of anything like this happening again.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Let's go to John now, calling from the UP. John, hi.
Hi, I had a question. When the pandemic first hit, I was off for about 2 months, and we were waiting for that $600 extra to be put into our accounts, and it ended up coming in, but there was a glitch in the system where it gave me the $600 a week extra, plus it gave me a $550, which come to find out it was if I were to get it with taxes taken out. So they actually overpaid me $2,040, which I was unaware of, and now the state's demanding the money back as soon as possible.
John, thanks for the call. That's he's in Michigan, outside of your jurisdiction, Secretary Pahacek. But in general, if somebody finds they're getting overpaid, I don't know how common that is. What can they do about it?
Yeah, so overpayments represent about 1% of total payments made through the system. And when you're looking at 2020, you know, the system paid $4.4 billion in unemployment benefits. So 1% is still a significant dollar amount. If somebody, has received an overpayment letter, there is a process outlined and an ability to connect with the department, at least here in Wisconsin, and work with us either through a repayment plan or potential waiver of repayment if it qualifies under statute.
Thanks for the call, John. Good luck getting that sorted out. We're talking to Secretary Designee Amy Pahacek from the Department of Workforce Development about unemployment compensation and claims here in the state. Back to your calls now. Kelsey is with us, calling from Madison. Kelsey, hi.
Hi, Secretary. Hi, Rob. I have an immediate family member who's one of those unlucky few who has not received any of her benefits. She's filed for 42 weeks. She's constantly calling unemployment. She's waiting to be denied for regular unemployment so that she can then apply for the PUI. I know that there was a recent update from Governor Evers that everyone had been assigned an adjudicator who has an outstanding case. She's always had an adjudicator, but she still doesn't have any answers. And we've been tweeting Governor Evers. We've been trying to be as resourceful as possible. But understandably, she's pretty frustrated and in some dire straits. So I'm just wondering if there's any other resource we might not have found.
Kelsey, thanks a lot for that call. So somebody who is in that cycle, Secretary Pahacek, of in adjudication, but it's taken a long time, lots of weeks. Are there things people can do to try to expedite things?
Yes, certainly. So I think the best way to go about this is to reach out to the adjudicator and understands that it sounds like it's been difficult for this claimant to do so. But we do have a help desk line that's toll-free number 844-910-3661. And certainly, you know, they can look into the status of the claim if there's documentation needed or any other supplemental information that would be referenced in the claim. And hopefully we could facilitate that conversation to get that, you know, ultimate determination.
Kelsey, good luck to friend or family member who's in that situation. And Secretary Pahacek, I understand that some people are in that cycle of adjudication. You know, sometimes unemployment is really simple. You had a job, you got laid off, you're unemployed. But there are a lot of things with gray areas. What kind of employee were you? Were you this many hours? That sort of thing. Is that where it gets complicated, where you end up with adjudication taking a lot longer than it might otherwise?
Yes, there are certain eligibility requirements as prescribed in state and federal law. And what we found out really through the exercise of trying to clear the backlog is that people often end up in adjudication because they're having a hard time following even just our application online. So that was another huge initiative that I started, Rob, was to rewrite our entire unemployment application. We looked at it and we found that it's full of legalese and jargon and just, again, very confusing. So people who might answer a question wrong, who should have just gone immediately through and been eligible and received their benefits immediately, may have just not quite understood what we were asking. So we have revamped the entire application. We used a technical language expert to put it into plain language so that regardless of somebody's educational background or regional or cultural differences, it should just be user-friendly, easy to understand, and hopefully prevent more people going into this question of eligibility. And so we released that for public comment that closed last week. But right now we're continuing doing focus groups with individuals just to make sure that we can make this as simple and easy as possible. But the other thing, Rob, that you hit on is some of the, you know, the recipiency laws in the state of Wisconsin are very difficult. You know, the reason why you are currently not working could disqualify you from receiving a benefit. And so, you know, from a policy perspective, if we could make these laws a little bit sort of more simple and transparent, I also think that would be an improvement.
We'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Amy Pahacek is the secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. We talked to her about Governor Evers' call for a special legislative session to overhaul the state's unemployment insurance system, as well as the backlog of unemployment insurance claims cleared at the end of 2020, getting everybody into adjudication at that point. For the last 10 months, traditional ways of mourning, like funerals and gatherings, have been disrupted. Despite the rising death tolls and daily counts we've grown accustomed to hearing. Even in normal times, our next guest writes, American mourning rituals are lacking. We don't have a lot of a connection between our living and dead or a means to mourn beyond the standard funeral service. So he created a unique way to create that connection by sending a text. The project is called Text Our Dead. Eric LeMay is an associate professor in the writing program at Ohio University and a host on the New Books Network. He's the author of several books. His work has appeared in the Paris Review, Poetry Daily, the Best Food Writing Series, and elsewhere. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you for the invitation.
Now, Text Our Dead, you write, was inspired by a Japanese garden designer, I think, who used a phone as a tool of mourning as well. Can you talk about that inspiration?
Sure. So there's a man in Japan. His name is Itaru Suzaki. He's a garden designer. He's in his 70s. And he lives in the town of Osuchi, which is on the east coast of Japan. And in 2010, his cousin and drinking buddy died of cancer. And Suzaki wanted some way to still feel a sense of connection. And so he did something which is, to my mind, very beautiful. He bought one of those old-timey telephone booths, and he set it up in his garden. It's a beautiful garden. It overlooks the sea. And he installed within it one of those black rotary phones that people might remember from an eon ago where you ran your finger along and dialed. And the phone isn't connected to anything. There's no signal. There's no line. You just pick it up, and you speak to your dead. And so he would have conversations with his cousin, and he called it Kaze no Denwa, the wind phone, or the phone of the wind. And it was the wind that carried your words to your dead. And then something really terrible happened. You might remember about a decade ago, there was that massive earthquake and terrible tsunami that hit the east coast of Japan. Where Suzaki lives. It was on March 11th, 2011. And so in a day, 16,000 people have died and another 2,500 are still missing. 500,000 were displaced. So since then, the wind phone has become something like a place of pilgrimage, people coming, sitting in the garden, eventually picking up the phone and talking to the ones that they've lost. And Suzaki set it up as a place of connection, a way not to lose those who have died. And so when I learned about the wind phone, I learned about it in the middle of this just a few weeks ago, really. And I thought, What would that look like for us in America right now in the middle of this pandemic? And so that's where this idea was born.
You got an extra cell phone, I guess, basically. What do people do if they want to participate in text?
This is one of those ideas born in the middle of the night, full of grief. So, yes, I bought a phone. I set up a phone line, created a website so that people could learn about it. And, yeah, you just send a text to someone who's dead. And you can, you know, if you've got listeners who are driving, they'll probably remember the website textourdead.org, and you can get the number there. But if somebody's scrolling through their phone as they're listening to you right now, the number is 1-740-590-7236. And you can send along whatever you want to say.
What kind of things have you heard so far?
A lot of grief, a lot of missing. Missing is probably the word that comes up the most, but also memories, right? I remember this. I remember the sound of your voice, the way it sounded like sweet wood and filled the room. Or I remember our 54th wedding anniversary. Or I haven't forgotten you. And I think that, you know, Sasaki's genius was that, you know, especially for American culture, it's not as much the same in Japan, but especially for American culture, we think we lose our dead, right? They're dead and gone, that there's this gulf between the living and the dead. But that's uniquely Western and uniquely American. In a lot of cultures, that connection goes on. And especially in this time of grieving that we're experiencing, where more Americans are dying faster now than ever in the history of our country, some way to channel that grief, some way to channel all of this emotion. We can't even get together and cry at this moment, much less hold a funeral or have a visitation.
It's a powerful mindset change to think about this. You know, the relationship with the person who died isn't over. It keeps going, not in a supernatural way, just in our minds. And in this case, texting is a way to speak to that. I don't know. It strikes me as really profound and a way I haven't really thought about death and grieving before. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think that, you know, so we have this, anyone who's lost someone that dies, you know what you go through, right? You think about them. You replay these memories. You hear their voice in your head. You find yourself talking to them. If you're like me, you might have found yourself speaking out loud at times. You know, I would say, Grandma Mary, I wish you could be here to see my five-year-old son. He just learned how to ride his bike, right? I don't say it like that. I'm like, oh, I wish you were here, Mary, right? So it's this very human thing that's already within us. We hold the voices of those we love in our head. And like you said, there's just this very strange idea that we don't feel like yet we can speak to them. And something changes when you do. You know, I just started texting some of my lost loved ones before I thought to offer it up as something that other people might find useful. And it shifts. It just shifts something to be able to send a message. And who knows what happens? You know, I'm not prepared to do a theology of texting or tell people what the cosmos is like, but it did shift for me my relationship to that person who's gone and the grief that I've been carrying. You know, and the amount of grief that we're carrying as a country right now is going to be so huge. We are in survival mode. We're trying to make it through. But there is this huge emotional weight and storm that's gathering, and we're going to need to find a way to support one another when we begin to reckon with these 400,000 deaths, these 500,000 deaths that are going to come. We've got to figure out some way to do it, and you know, maybe this is some small way.
And this is hopefully soon we'll be able to get together and mourn our dead. This is at least a small but safe way. It's something we could do, like we could literally do it right now without having to go out and expose ourselves to further illness. Do we need more things like that, do you think? Small ways to cope with that grief, at least for now?
I think so. You know, Sasaki, when he did the wind phone, he said that there's something about you pick up the phone and you're already primed to talk. And he would have been of a generation that would have chatted on the phone. And, you know, we're now in a moment where people tend to text more than they call. Certainly no one's writing, you know, snail mail letters anymore, anything like that. And he thought the fact that you were already in this mode where you were already talking, right? That just allowed it to happen, that things would flow as opposed to, you know, a formal funeral oration or something like that. And so, you know, you open your phone and you just start composing a text and you're already going because we compose texts all the time, and you start your emojis and you include a photo and suddenly something is happening and you're able to grieve and you're able to mourn, maybe, right? But right now we're so cut off from any other avenue of mourning that trying other ways of doing, you know, the act of grief seems worthwhile. What do we have to lose?
Eric,
we've already lost them.
Yes. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Sure thing, Rob. Thank you for having me.
That's Eric LeMay, associate professor in the writing program at Ohio University. He is the creator of the Text Our Dead Project. You can read some of the texts on his website. It is textourdead.org. You can follow them on Twitter. It is @text_our. If you want to send a text to someone you've lost, you can call 740-590-7236. You can find that number at the website, textourdead.org. And we've got the website, by the way, linked at wpr.org/centraltime. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about family politics for this week's presidential inauguration.
Believe it or not, not everyone agrees when it comes to politics. And in the current political climate, those differences are especially amplified when trying to have these discussions with family. Waukesha writer Judy Bridges walks us through the complex arc of navigating politics and finding common ground with her distant brother.
My brother lives 3,000 miles away from me, in Alaska, where he built a successful business while his wife raised the children. Brother and I were close as kids, not so close during the middle, busy years, and now good friends again, except for politics, where he is the great white hunter and I'm the bra burner. I never actually burned a bra, and he doesn't hunt anymore. Still, we are far left, far right, the difference that's torn so many friends and families apart, especially now, when smart, decent people are convinced of opposing sets of facts. Our whole country is lined up on one side or the other, and the sides are more likely to spit at each other than talk over the fence. Like it or not, we need to find paths we can walk together. It's clear that we aren't going to argue this out. I can't convince my brother of my thinking, and he can't convince me of his. All that happens when we try is that we back each other into corners we aren't going to come out of. The issues are too hot, our convictions too ingrained. The best we can do is just be together. Earlier this year, my brother asked for my opinions. He said everyone in his circle thinks the way he does. He knows I think differently, and he respects me enough to ask the questions. We tried, both of us. We knew that once upon a time we could talk and come to consensus. Not anymore. Our language had become loaded. Sentences we thought were neutral were unwitting attempts to convince. We swore off politics. Conversations became thinner and less frequent. One day I found a photo of us taken when we were kids, and our biggest disagreement was who beat who in a bike race. I posted the pic on Facebook with this caption: "The love we share is deeper than the distance between us." This photo was taken the year after my mom married his dad, and we got each other in the bargain. Politically, we're miles apart, but we'd each take a bullet for the other. The posting opened the door again, for a while. Then silence. I sent him a note. "Let's not let politics stand in the way of love. How about we connect at least once a week? He agreed. Now our conversations go something like this. Me, I'm brewing a pot of bean soup today, the kind you like. Bro, I'd love to have a bowl of that. It's 9 degrees up here. That's it. Plus updates on his antique autos and my book sales. Will we switch sides? Probably not. But we have cleared a path we can walk together. There is kindness. There is love. There is hope. And a big bubbling pot of bean soup.
Judy Bridges is an author and educator based in Waukesha. The music in this story is by R. Boyd and Dusk. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Since the first COVID-19 vaccine started arriving in Wisconsin for distribution last month, the push to get frontline medical workers and others in the first priority group vaccinated has been underway. State Republicans have been critical of Governor Evers' handling of the rollout so far, while the Evers administration says it's doing what it can, despite not receiving the amount of vaccine initially promised by the federal government. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He sits on the CDC Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, COVID-19 Vaccine Work Group. Dr. Tempty, welcome back.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
From where you're sitting, how do you think Wisconsin is doing in terms of the initial vaccine rollout?
Well, I have to say, when we put it in perspective, we're doing actually pretty good. If you go back to where I was back in July or August, I was thinking we weren't going to be seeing any vaccine until April or even later. And to have vaccine authorized for use in December was fantastic. And the fact that we're actually rolling it out, I don't think we're talking about a catch-up right now. We're actually kind of a jump start or a head start. We're not doing too bad.
Now, when I look at some of the politics around it at the national level, we've got criticism from the incoming administration of the Trump administration's handling of the rollout at the national level. Here in Wisconsin, Republicans criticizing Governor Evers. When I look at the numbers, the U.S. compared to other developed countries, behind a few, ahead of a bunch of others. Wisconsin, low, middle, average by the statistics I see people using. I don't know. How are we doing badly at the bureaucratic rollout, getting the vaccines from production into people's arms?
Well, let's just say it's a really challenging endeavor. I also work with our state disaster medical advisory committee. And the challenge out there is every vaccinator in Wisconsin, and there's 1,200 of us, we all have to sign an agreement saying that we're going to adhere to the regulations and recommendations of CDC and ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. The challenge out there has been a always changing landscape. We have rapidly changing recommendations out there. So when we started, definitely healthcare personnel was first in line. But then we have all sorts of other things happening. For example, we were told from the federal government that half the doses were going to be held back to assure that everybody gets the second dose, only to find out later that they've sent out all the vaccine. We had an announcement that everybody age 65 and older and with medical conditions were going to be eligible. And the problem that that causes is it creates a target that is far, far, far too big for the vaccine supply that we have. The other challenge is we never know from week to week how much vaccine is going to be allocated to the state of Wisconsin. So if you can kind of imagine, it is a really precarious position to try and make any promises out there. And the best we can do is try to keep the target size as small as we can so not to amp up expectation and at the same time being able to deliver on promises.
One challenge here seems to be, okay, we know who our priorities are, frontline medical workers, older people, people who are at the most medical risk. But if we're really trying to get it to those people in particular, it might slow down the rate of overall vaccine delivery to people. And, you know, part of the goal is just to have as many people vaccinated as soon as possible to start putting a dent in the spread. How do we balance that?
Well, absolutely. And I really totally. The most important thing is to get as much vaccine into as many willing people as quickly as possible. And the rub comes in, how do you actually go about doing that? First and foremost, for Wisconsin, we have about 550,000 healthcare personnel and people in long-term care facilities or nursing homes. And that was our first priority. And we're about 30% of the way, 40% for coverage there. But beyond that, once we start opening the doors, then we have to be really wise as to who gets it next. In Wisconsin, there's a great priority to getting K through 12 schools back running again. We worry about our police and fire, our first line individuals out there. There are other priority groups out there, and particularly those over the age of 70. For Wisconsin, that's a group that has had the highest rate of hospitalization and death out there. But when you put all those people together, that brings up another 1.1, 1.2 million people out there. And again, it puts that expectation out there that is going to be really hard to catch up to. So we just have to some regard, be a little bit patient here and let things play out at the same time, hoping that we get as much vaccine as possible.
As we wrap up, what are you watching for on the supply side? Is the speed of production of the two existing ones or maybe future ones picking up at all?
Well, the good news out there are two additional vaccines that are getting close to that point where they can be approved through the emergency use authorization by FDA. And once that happens, we're going to have much more abundance of vaccine. On the flip side of the coin, the other thing we watch very carefully is that level of declination or people refusing to get vaccinated. And we just can't afford to have too many people refuse, especially as we're seeing new strains come out that are even more contagious than what we're used to. Because once we have viruses out there that are more contagious, what that means is we're going to have more and more people vaccinated to get up to a new higher herd immunity threshold.
Dr. Tempty, thanks again for joining us and bringing us up to date.
Well, thanks for having me and have a beautiful afternoon.
That's Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He is on the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices COVID-19 Vaccine Workgroup. We talked to him today about the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines here in Wisconsin and around the country.